This is election interference, and we are 19 days out from an election. It has no precedent in the history of democracy. The Senate Judiciary Committee wants to know what the hell is going on. Chairman Lindsey Graham and I have discussed this at length, and the committee today will be noticing a markup on Tuesday to issue a subpoena to Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee next Friday, to come before this committee and the American people and explain why Twitter is abusing their corporate power to silence the press and to cover up allegations of corruption. And let me be clear, I don't know.
That was not an old-timey radio hour reproduction with the footprints in the background. That was, in fact, Senator Ted Cruz late last week promising to haul Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey in front of Congress to ask about election interference, by which he means the social media company's decision, which it later reversed, confusingly, to suppress a New York Post article alleging that Hunter Biden in 2015 arranged a meeting between his paymasters at the Ukrainian oil company Burisma and his then vice president, Father Joe. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined by my colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and special pre-election guest star, managing editor Stephanie Slade. Please clap. Come on down. Hi, everybody.
Matt, I'm riding on a horse here. I'm trying to ride on a horse while I say hello. I'm catching up to Ted Cruz, who's in Colonial Guard.
You got the coconuts. So what began last Wednesday as a, you know, run-of-the-mill Rudy Giuliani, Steve Bannon oppo dump in the New York Post quickly blew up into something much weirder even than that when Twitter blocked people from even sharing the Post's scoop. It froze the New York Post Twitter account, weirdly, and then started making all sorts of contradiction-filled excuses for its actions. You're not supposed to publish things based on, like, anonymous sourcing. Good luck with that standard. In the meantime, the story blew up. President Donald Trump called it the second biggest scandal in the history of the United States. And so vociferous were Washington's calls for retaliatory regulation that Federal Communications Commission Chair Ajit Pai issued a pretty weirdly worded kind of statement saying that the FCC would soon begin a rulemaking process to decide what Section 230 of the 1996 Communication Decency Act really means. Big mess. Nick, I want you to first take a victory lap in Suderman's kitchen here. Doesn't this episode kind of illustrate a point that you've made here before, which is that once we start saying, hey, it's good, it's a private company policing its own, you know, actions, why should we get mad about, you know, people defining what they want for free speech? Doesn't that quickly become a slippery slope towards censoriousness, not just privately, but from the government's standpoint?
I don't know exactly about that, but I will say this, Matt, that, you know, what Twitter did was egregious and outrageous. And I don't think the government should be involved necessarily. But, you know, this is when we think about how do you deal with organizations that you want to reform or that you then that you interact with? And Albert Hirschman in his great early 70s book, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, suggested three responses to states, firms, and organizations in decline. One was exit. You get out and you go, you light out for the territory and you start your own thing. Another was loyalty. You just suck it up and become a company man and just put up with whatever crap gets dealt with you. And the other is voice, which is that you use whatever processes are officially or unofficially available to work within the system to change it. This is, people should be screaming bloody murder about this. What Twitter did was just outrageous. And the fact that they came up with shifting rationales for why this one story, this New York Post story, which is based on hacked emails, you know, which may or may not be true, although the Biden campaign hasn't, you know, denounced them or shown them to be false or anything like that, it's pretty amazing when you consider all of the stuff that goes out there, the saving grace of this, and this is where I think people who use Twitter, independent of political partisanship, need to say this is really screwed up. This makes Twitter a crappier platform than it was when it was helping, foment or enable or allow the Arab Spring to unfold. This is outrageous, and we need to make it, if those of us who use Twitter, like, just not to put up with this kind of crap.
Suderman, do we really want to live in a world where, you know, Twitter is suspending the accounts of Kayleigh McEnany?
Maybe a better question is, or a different question at least, is do we really want to live in a world with Twitter? I'm not sure I do. I have chosen to live in a world without Facebook. I have talked about here before. That was a good decision on my part. I just feel more confident in that every single day. I would probably get off of Twitter if it wasn't quite useful for my work. And I have spent, I've taken time in the last couple of years. I've taken weeks or months where my account is just deactivated, and I'm just not paying attention to it. And that's a choice that all of us can make. And I think Twitter in particular erred here. It's probably a little bit of a different scenario at Facebook, which is much more of a kind of big, kludgy bureaucracy and shuffles articles into its fact-checking process and then temporarily restricts them during the fact-checking process, just as a matter of course. And they do that all the time behind the scenes with articles that don't have any sort of political valence, and therefore we don't notice it when they're doing that with, say, articles about fake news stories that aren't Babylon Bee or Onion stories about how Tom Cruise has died, for example, that sort of thing. But also just...
Tom Cruise is dead?
No, right? Again. He's not dead. God. And Facebook demotes articles that say he is, or headlines like that, when they're sort of triggered by their internal algorithmic checks on what is getting passed around and that needs to be put into the fact-checking queue. I do think that Twitter in particular erred. They obviously had no kind of coherent justification for what they were doing here. It was a bad decision. It is one that is going to come back to haunt all of us, I think, in terms of the ripple effects it's likely to have on online speech regulation, and it's going to come back to haunt them in particular. At the same time, I'm not entirely certain that this is a bad world to live in, or even a world that's that much different from the one we lived in before. If you think of Amazon or Walmart or any physical store, think of a bookstore. They're not under obligation to carry every product. If Amazon stops carrying my favorite brand of coffee, it's not the end of the world. Or even if they decline to carry a book, which is speech, a political book, in an election year, it might mean I have to go somewhere else to get my favorite brand of coffee or to buy a copy of that book. And it might indeed have effects on the broader marketplace for coffee or for books. Those sorts of books might have a harder time making it to readers and might not be published as much. That type of coffee might go the way of the dinosaur. Some vendors might be forced to change their business models, but this has always been sort of part of the world we live in, which is that organizations, companies, decide which products they're going to carry and which ones they aren't. And sometimes those decisions are idiosyncratic and political, and sometimes they're just an ordinary part of the way they do business.
I think that's a really, a miscomparison. Because, do any of us remember a moment where you tried to link to something and Twitter said, no, we're not even letting you, link to that? In an election, this is, it's egregious. It's ridiculous, and it is out of character with the very platform itself. If Amazon said, we have the warehouse space to carry absolutely everything, and we're going to sell everything, and then they start, but, when you try to post something or sell something, and they say, no, because we don't like the political import of that, which is clearly what's going on here. People are right to be upset. This is an important issue, and Twitter and social media more broadly, I think, need to come up with a rationale and then to actually explain that and then live by it. And this is contrary to the spirit and the message of everything that Twitter really has stood for.
I'll give you the spirit and message thing. I just want to ask real quick, I want to ask, do you think, it sounds like what you're saying is that Facebook and Twitter have a public obligation, that they have some sort of obligation to play a role in the political process.
Have a corporate obligation.
It's an obligation to the public. Is what you're saying.
It's to its users. It's not to the public. It's to the people who use it. You know, and I think this is the type of thing. And again, we have three options, you know, exit, voice, and loyalty. I like Twitter a lot. It's on balance is good and things like that. The question isn't that we're not in a cafeteria in a Soviet, office building where we just take whatever the slop they throw in front of us on the line. We are active participants and members of the Twitter community. And I think everybody who's bothered by this, because if it's happening like this, it's going to happen in other contexts. It's going to bite everybody on the ass. This is a great example of where what social media companies should do in general, I think. And of course, they're going to have subgroups and all of that kind of stuff, is do as little content moderation as possible and give users the tools that they can have in order to create the experience they want. That was the promise of social media. That is the great benefit of it. This is a violation of that spirit. And I say that as a Twitter user, as a very active Twitter user. I'm not saying it as a senator, and I'm not saying it as a political speech crusader or anything like that.
Slade, go.
I just wanted to say, I think it is important in this case to distinguish between the principle of whether these companies, private companies, have the right to set the terms of service and decide what their platform, their technology creation may and may not be used for, even to keep certain kinds of speech off if they so choose. The principle of whether that's all legitimate and the particular application in this case. So you can have the principle that's legitimate, and I would defend it on a general level, at the level of principles, and still criticize the way that that principle was exercised, or, you know, that the way that that right was exercised in this case as hypocritical, you know, it's clear to me that I think we're all in agreement that Twitter really screwed up in this instance. But whether you want to then say, and therefore I'm right to say that we ought to regulate it, or even that we ought to deny their legitimate right to have some moderation of the content on their platform, I wouldn't go that far. I would say they really screwed up here, and it's right to criticize them, but I still think it's important to defend the fact that this is a private company and nobody has the right to use somebody else's, you know, product or property in a way in the way that I, the user, deem appropriate, as opposed to the way that you, the provider of the service, you know, wants to offer it.
And the reason that we say that is that, and we wouldn't say that in some other kind of instances where we're criticizing an editorial decision at, say, a newspaper, is that there is actual threatened legislation. There are people saying, let's get CEOs on the docket. There are people who want to break up Facebook and whatnot. Go on, Nick.
Well, yeah, no, I was going to say that this is, you know, part of the problem for this. This is not simply lefties or, you know, presumed people who are liberal to left to progressive saying, you know, we love free speech, except when it complicates what we want people to understand and read and how to see the world. So we're going to censor this. You have the same thing happening. And that's, on wonderful display in that horrible Ted Cruz kind of rant at the beginning of this, where you have conservatives who are constantly railing about free speech, et cetera. And literally, I mean, people like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and a couple of other people in the Republican, part of the Senate have talked about regulating social media companies as utilities, increasing government oversight on explicitly political speech. You know, they're full of it too. One of the saving graces of this, and I guess if we take it out of a political context and put it more back into an internet or digital culture context, which is kind of fun, is that, you know, this was also a classic case of a Streisand effect thing. Arguably, Twitter made this a bigger story by acting so doltishly. And for a while, when they banned the actual link to the story, one of the biggest stories on Twitter that was trending was the New York Post had written a follow-up story about Twitter banning the original story. And that became like one of the most trafficked pieces on Twitter for a day or so. So that, you know, this is what is so frustrating about this kind of stuff. There is, I, you know, is that the attempts to hide it sometimes work, but generally fail and backfire pretty spectacularly.
Peter, is there not a case here of some of this being the old working the refs analogy, by which I mean now journalists, especially after the 2016 election? I mean, it was interesting to hear Ted Cruz use the phrase election interference, which was like an MSNBC, style guide for 2.5 years there about everything having to do with Facebook was election interference, as if, you know, what a social media company does is akin to changing the vote at the ballot box. But you've had journalists, you know, many of them internalizing, you know, what went wrong in 2016. Well, one of the things that they have said, and you see this on Twitter and elsewhere, and kind of lobbied, you know, Facebook and Twitter over and over again, you know, hey, Jack, don't let the president spread misinformation, kind of thing. Haven't journalists kind of successfully browbeaten the social media companies and or, you know, the social media companies' own employees who tend to be in Silicon Valley, who tend to lean left and Democratic? And so isn't this kind of a less a, hey, you know, this is my ideal version of my own kind of walled or garden or curated garden here, and more I'm just giving way to a pressure campaign from kind of weaponized media and journalistic culture?
To answer your question, I actually want to read a headline from another podcast, Sway, which is the interview show with tech luminaries that is hosted by Kara Swisher at the New York Times. And one of her most recent episodes was an interview with Alex Stamos, who is the former Facebook chief information security officer, now works for Stanford doing internet stuff, whatever. And the headline is, "Can Big Tech Make Sure That 2020 Is Not 2016? That is the headline. That is the central question. That's that idea. Like, it's a question headline that tells you exactly what people on both sides. So this is a former high-level internal Facebook employee as talking to a high-level tech journalist. And the assumption that this conversation is built on is that the media and that big tech, in particular speech platforms like Facebook and Twitter, have a responsibility to make sure that the election goes differently.
You know, one of the interesting kind of ripples of all of this, and it builds on what Peter's talking about, is do you remember when WikiLeaks did its first massive dump of stuff that had to do with the U.S. actions as well as diplomatic U.S. actions in the Middle East and Afghanistan and all over the world? There was a real sense of excitement about that. And then when Snowden, you know, made his revelations, people suddenly got a lot more, things got a lot more complicated because it was under Obama. And then, you know, when WikiLeaks released, the Hillary Clinton emails, then suddenly WikiLeaks is really kind of evil, right? And, you know, this was the pretense for Twitter not allowing the New York Post story to go, is that it had hacked materials. You know, hacked materials are the Pentagon Papers. And then they were like, well, it's hacked materials that are, as long as they're not directly released to the, into the wild where people could actually read them and make up their minds. The Silicon Valley elite has been lying to itself and been selling an image that they are, you know, the commanders of the world. They're Ozymandias and the Watchmen. They can control everything they do. There's that horrible dumb documentary that was big a couple weeks ago, The Social Dilemma, where you had a bunch of people, it was all predicated upon the idea that, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, are the new hidden persuaders, and they can make you buy whatever they want. They can make you feel however they want you to feel. It's all bullshit, but it's coming home to roost now because these people think that they are running the world, and as a result, they have a very oversized sense of their responsibility. And it's something that we need to combat, you know, both in specific instances, I think, like Twitter, raise holy hell about that, but that larger cultural understanding of the power of the media, meaning Facebook and Twitter, et cetera, to structure our lives. We need to combat that as a concept, because ultimately is wrong and it is better to be more open than to be more algorithmic and closed and sludgy and self-important.
No, I just want to say real quickly, though, that that idea, that self-conception that you mentioned, Nick, that they kind of run the world and can pull the levers of speech and thus influence power, is also an idea that their critics have as well. And that, and so,
absolutely.
And so when Ted Cruz is saying that this is election interference and it's totally unprecedented in history, and what the hell is going on, when Matt Gaetz is calling, as he has, Representative Matt Gaetz, who represents my home district in Florida, calling for the FCC and the FEC to get involved because Charlie Kirk apparently can't get into his Twitter accounts, they are also working from the assumption that these organizations are incredibly powerful and, you know, sort of, and need to have some sort of public oversight. And this is, I guess, why I was asking you earlier about whether you thought that Twitter and Facebook have a public obligation in some sense, because to me, that kind of thinking is how we get to the idea that these companies should be treated effectively like utilities. Because when you start to think that these big companies have public obligations, have social obligations that go beyond doing their business as companies, and I agree that their political critics have that assumption. They have that assumption inside, but we shouldn't. Is sort of my approach here.
Yeah, I'm saying as a consumer, though, that's the real thing. Because of course, anytime a business gets powerful, they're going to get called into Congress. You know, it happened with railroads, it happened with oil companies, it happened with tobacco companies, it happens with media companies, and you know, particularly anything that's not print in America. Because the government has had a role in regulating broadcast TV and radio, and made throughout the 90s, made a play to control the internet along with cable TV content and things like that. So, and I think this is where a specifically and a uniquely libertarian position is important, because, you know, right now you see very clearly the right and the left, both in power, in political power and in cultural power, looking at these things as, you know, media that they want to control. And that is the wrong way to think about it. You know, it's much better to keep these services as clear and as open as possible. But it also does mean that they need to be better. They need to be better to their consumers. You know, who was served? Who was served by Twitter blocking this?
Slade, you spend a lot of time paying attention to kind of the political currents on the right and where conservatism is going. Seems to me that a lot of where the juice is at with the kind of trend towards populist conservatism or sort of semi-nationalist conservatism, there's been a lot of embracing of this kind of Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton, I don't know actually if Cotton qualifies, style rhetoric about, we got to break up Facebook. You know, it's Tucker Carlson is going after social media all the time. Can you talk a little bit about the role of kind of interest of regulating media, which is kind of a new thing, I think, for the Republican Party? What is the role or the importance of that in the trends that you're watching within conservatism?
This is one example of the larger trend. I've described this as the great liberalism schism, which is that, and it's happening on the left as well, but I focus mostly on its, you know, manifestation on the right, which is that it used to be that people who identified as conservatives or right of center, they believed in, or at least claimed, you know, persuasively to believe in, limited government, individual liberty, keeping the state out of people's businesses and out of people's lives. And now there is a whole swath of the political right who have decided that, you know, we tried that and it didn't really lead where we hoped it would. And so let's throw that into the garbage can and go and instead pivot to supporting a big, robust central government that is interfering in the economy in various ways in order to try to bring about the outcomes that we want. And one instance of that is this right-wing push for regulation of tech companies on the grounds that these private companies are behaving in a way that is unfair or, you know, immoral. And I can't help but roll my eyes at this, because I spent all of the Obama years and up until not that long ago arguing about why, you know, bakers and florists should have the right to run their businesses in ways that the left finds immoral or unfair. that they should be allowed to decide whether or not to do business in one way or another. And even if some large swath of their potential customers don't like it, if they decide to accept the commercial consequences of making that decision, the state should stay out of it.
And if Joe Biden wins and the Senate is retaken by Democrats, we may go back to having that argument on a pretty regular basis again.
Yeah, sure. And then everybody's going to immediately switch sides again. This is the way it goes. But so,
although with social media, they won't. You know, I mean, I think what will happen, and this is one of the reasons why it's so scary, is that, you know, if the Democrats take the Senate and Elizabeth Warren, who's the loudest proponent of breaking up Facebook or regulating these companies, you know, using antitrust law, Ted Cruz, he's not going to be like, oh, how dare you? He's just going to add on. He's going to make sure that his concerns are part of that, which is really
the two
what's
forms of social media regulation that the left and the right are right now. It sounds a little bit to us like they're strange bedfellows on the same side of this issue, but they want to regulate these companies in precisely contradictory ways. The left wants to regulate, you know, social media companies and say, you may not spread misinformation. And that's the left. And the right wants to regulate them and say, you may not keep things that you deem to be bad for, you know, the public good off of social media. So you can't really reconcile those two positions. It's going to be a power struggle.
Although the right also wants to make sure that you can't, you know, show cuties on Netflix or, you know, or write positive. I mean, it's not quite to the point of that where they want to restrict positive reviews about it, but that's like the next step. The right is certainly interested in a kind of censorious approach to some of this. It's just that that's less front and center right now with big tech companies restricting.
So you're right.
Content that is perceived to be beneficial to Republicans.
I should say it's largely contradictory,
right,
except where the Venn diagram overlaps, and in that overlap is cuties.
It's bad.
Oh, I just enjoy
that. Maybe that's the problem with the New York Post story, is that now we're not talking about cuties anymore.
I know.
Which, what was that, like 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago?
I mean,
a thousand years ago.
Yeah. It's...
What crimes have you not committed, David French? Just shaking my damn head. No, I'm just thinking out loud of the great thing that sits in the middle of this discussion every day. I forget what the Twitter follow is, but every day Facebook releases its top 10 pages, and it's just all Ben Shapiro, Dan Bongino, a bunch of right-wing stuff, and this drives the left crazy, and it makes the...
You know, it drives Facebook employees crazy. It doesn't... Who is even the left? I mean, that's one of the funniest things about all of this, is that you have... Because right when this was happening, too, Mark Zuckerberg relented and changed course on allowing Holocaust denial posts, however that gets defined, on Facebook. And a couple of years ago, you know, he over the past several years, he's gone from being a super free speech advocate to saying, you know, it's time to regulate, and I want to help you, Congress, write those regulations. You know, and he said that in front of Congress a couple of years ago. Then he became a free speech activist again, because Elizabeth Warren is actually serious about cutting, you know, breaking up his company. Now he's gone back to saying, oh yeah, we're going to get rid of that. And it's because the rank and file of these companies are all like, you know, they're disgusted whenever they see anything on a site that they somehow disagree with, which is all the time.
This is all against the backdrop of the election. So let's kind of move in that direction, since we have another, the last presidential debate is happening on Thursday. It's going to be very exciting. We, whenever Slade is on, we obviously have to have the segment of Ask Slade about whether we can start reading the polls yet. I note that this morning, Slade, that 538 says we're way past the point where a normal polling error could let Trump close the gap. He's Joe Biden's up by, I think, 10.7 percentage points in the national polls right now. Although Hillary Clinton was up 6.9 in 2016 and Mitt Romney was up 1.2 in 2012. So, Slade, give us a quick tour, if you would, of how or like what errors of reporting or cognition do you see with people talking about polls right now? Or what are the polls telling you that can be of interest in spreading the media literacy of our treasured Reason Roundtable listeners?
Sure. I think, you know, the point that I have been making for the last few years, when every time I come on the show and say, you know, don't trust the polls, it's too early, is that it was too early. It was too early back then. That is not my critique now. I mean, in the weeks leading right up to the election, this is the time when the polls are most valuable and can and have the most to tell us. So it's fine to be looking at the polls and to be, you know, putting some faith in what they're telling us. And the fact that the sort of the spread right now between the two candidates is even larger than the sort of margin of error on each individual candidate's support levels suggests, you know, it suggests that we can have a little more confidence than we would be able to if it was a 4 or a 6 point spread. When you have a poll and each there's a margin of error of plus or minus 3 points, that's plus or minus 3 points on the on Biden's support number and plus or minus 3 points on Trump's support number. And so if they're within 6 points of each other, you shouldn't be as confident as you would be if they were outside of 6 points of each other. And so we are outside of that now. Is that that's sort of the 538, the point that they're making with that article. That said, there are other things, there are things to keep in mind, one of which is that people will continue to make up their minds and change their minds right up until the election. And I know that's hard for the type of person who, you know, listens to a political podcast every week to remember, because you probably have made up your mind a long time ago if you're listening to this podcast, but many people have not.
Hey, Slade, I'm curious about the state versus national polls issue, because you've been mostly talking about the national polls, and they obviously show Joe Biden winning by a pretty or leading by a pretty big margin. They showed Hillary Clinton leading by a somewhat less big margin in 2016. And the national polls, though, in 2016 were actually not too far off. My understanding is
not at all, right?
Because Hillary Clinton actually won the popular vote. The issue was that state level polling in a handful of key states was wrong. Is that something that we need to be thinking about this time around?
And so if you look at, for example, Real Clear Politics does a battleground states average. So you can look at, you know, what is Biden's lead in Florida, in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, in Wisconsin. And what you're going to find is that he's up in all those states, but it's much closer. So none of this is a sure thing. And looking at state polls is always going to be more accurate when you're in a country with an electoral college, where ultimately what matters is state outcomes and not the national outcome. The problem, though, a complicating factor is that not every state has a lot of high quality pollsters doing survey research in it. And so you sometimes will get a polling average that is like two polls, you know, one from the local newspaper and, you know, maybe somebody has come in nationally and done a poll in that state or something. And you always can trust a polling average with a lot of data points more than one with a few data points. And so that's just, it's why this is also complicated and why often it makes more sense to, or it doesn't make more sense to look at the national average, but you can feel more confident that the national average is going to get it right because there are just so many more pieces of data going into that average.
One of the striking things from 2016 that I rediscovered not that long ago is if you look at Wisconsin, which is a state that famously Trump won by a small margin, there wasn't a single poll the entire election in which Trump was winning in Wisconsin. So Wisconsin right now is it's a safe Biden state, like 7-8 percentage points difference, but keep that in the back of your mind. But also, it is true that a lot of polling companies, in response to 2016, changed their weighting mechanisms because they thought that they were undercounting white non-college age voters. There's an under response. I want to turn that into a related question, Slade, before we really...
Are you going to start attacking the white man again, Matt?
Have I ever stopped is the question.
Non-college educated white man, Matt?
Yes.
You know, just come on, deal with it in therapy.
what do you think this is? I'm only paying you $100 an hour here.
My copays never get covered, so.
Slade, there's a theory out there. This is the graduated, Bradley effect theory here, but that there's a shy Trump voter theory. People either don't want to admit because it is potentially harmful in their social or professional circles. They don't want to admit that they're going to vote for Trump, or in the Scott Adams interpretation, they're on purpose telling people that they're actually voting for Biden because they want to make the surprise punk election day thing even that bigger. Is there a reason to believe that there is a shy Trump voter affecting the polls?
There's little reason to believe that. There have been a number of studies done by APOR, the American Association of Public Opinion Research. Morning Consult polling outfit just recently did one. 538 has looked into it. And what they find is, you know, in 2015, there actually was some evidence of this. When you poll somebody online where they feel more anonymous, they were more likely to say they were thinking about supporting Donald Trump than if you call them up and talk to them on the phone where they feel a little less anonymous. But that phenomenon went away even you know, when we got to 2016, to closer to the actual general election, and they're not finding any evidence of it right now. There is a thing that could be happening, which I'm just sort of hypothesizing here, but the main problem with polling these days is that people don't answer their phones, right? You know, when was the last time you answered your phone for somebody, an anonymous person you didn't know who's calling? And so as Donald Trump has sort of fomented ever more distrust and hostility toward, quote, elite institutions, which includes the media, and the media is one of the main drivers of public opinion polling, perhaps his supporters are less likely to talk to pollsters. I mean, that could, but that's just a hypothesis. We won't know until after the election, until the sort of postmortem happens, which is the real problem with polling, is you don't know whether you're getting it right or not until after the fact. And there's always a chance that you're going to see some new phenomenon that you hadn't quite been prepared for, you know, in the run up.
But there's no reason seriously to doubt. I mean, like this, at this point, it's Biden's to win. Every indication is that Biden is going to win, and probably he may not break 50%, but he's going to do better than Hillary did.
One thing that
I'm asking that to Slate, actually.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I mean, it has been unusually stable. The polling, you know, averages have been unusually stable. Whereas 4 years ago, there were sort of ups and downs for both Hillary and Trump. We haven't seen that this time. But, you know, just going back to that point about the battleground states are really where the election is likely to be decided. And each one of those battleground states is closer than the national average. So I embarrassed myself badly 4 years ago by making predictions. And so I'm trying to not make that mistake again.
Nick, there one thing that is affecting a weird factor this year is that close to 30 million people have already voted.
Yeah.
Here. I think I recall seeing you on Twitter, your favorite website, suggesting that you don't like all that early voting, or that there's something wrong with it. What's your problem with democracy, Nick?
Yeah, you know, democracy, Matt, I think, don't you understand that we live in an autocracy? We live in a white supremacist autocracy. So why are we constantly talking about democracy or even republicanism?
But is it a college-educated white supremacist oligopoly?
Well, you know, but everybody goes to college now. Like, a college degree is like a junior high, you know, diploma, Matt, 5 years ago. It's all debased.
It's called middle school now. That's how old you are.
No, I know that. I was calling that. I grew up in America not only with junior highs, but in my hometown, there was a junior high that had a shooting range in the basement.
Oof.
So, you know, go figure. Where's that? Where's my America, Matt? Where are my, you know, forget about industrial jobs. I want junior high schools with shooting ranges. My point about that, and that was also part of the 538 story, which is that the election is kind of partly over, you know, and what's going to be 30 or 40% of people voting outside of showing up on election day. So, you know, like a sizable chunk of stuff, it's already happening. What I was talking about was early voting, you know, and I guess some states had it even happening in September. But, you know, especially with two guys who both, and, you know, let's not let a moment pass without pointing out that Donald Trump and Joe Biden are not only the two oldest candidates in like human history, but they're two of the very worst. I mean, this is really a choice between Frankenstein and the Wolfman or something. This is just bad all the way down. But, you know, if let's say you vote on October 1st, and then, you know, not only do the Hunter Biden stories come out, but like one or both of these schmoes dies, you know, between now and the election, which is not at all odd. I mean, you know, in an era with like COVID, which, you know, supposedly is killing everybody, you know, I mean, like, it just strikes me as a weird thing. I mean, I like the idea of having more people vote and making it easier to vote. But the early voting, I mean, I think what that means is that we just have more people able to vote easily on election day, or we make a 3 or 4 day period, make it a national holiday if you want, and vote then. I find early voting disturbing, especially in an era where news is, news happens fast and changes quickly.
Slate always says you can't trust the polls. You know, it's too early. I'm worried that even a week after the election, that's still going to be true.
Yeah, no, I agree. And well, you should always have the right to change your vote for at least 6 months. You know, it's kind of like giving children back after you take them home from the hospital. You should have a 6 month grace period.
Six-year, 16 years. yeah. We are going to have our final debate here. I want to know from the class, starting with Suderman. This past week, we saw dueling. Is it this past week? What are we? Monday? What?
It was literally last Thursday.
It was only like 5 days ago.
It was last week, Matt.
It was like a couple years ago. There was a dueling town hall things. I don't know which ones you guys watch, but Suderman, was there any one thing that you even remember from last week's town halls with Joe Biden and Donald Trump, or Joe Jorgensen, for that matter?
Oh, nobody watched that one, Matt.
Matt, that because one, that one was the good biased. One. I watched most of the Donald Trump town hall and the last 30 minutes or so of the Joe Biden town hall. And I think two things stuck out to me. One was just the contrast in tones and tenors of the two events. The Trump event was high energy, let's say. It was kind of manic. And in part, that was because this is the other thing that that jumped out to me was the moderator, Savannah Guthrie, on the Trump event, basically played the role of the debate opponent. And I thought in many ways she did a pretty good job, but it was unusual. She kept the conversation moving. She actually got information out of him, right? It wasn't, there were a lot of interjections, but they didn't feel like just chaos like the first debate did. You actually felt like you were learning something about how Donald Trump responds to objections that are substantive in real time, which I think was useful. But it was supposed to be a town hall, and I don't know if there was a question for the first 15 or 20 minutes. And if there was, maybe there was. I think there was only one. It was basically just the moderator grilling Donald Trump, and then you had the other event with Joe Biden, which was so boring. So just like ordinary and normal, and reminded you of how political events used to be, not this sort of high energy, manic kind of just, almost deranged kind of I don't even know what I was like. Trump is just a weird guy who has done weird things to politics, and politics used to be kind of calm and a little bit wonky and nerdy and earnest, and Joe Biden would just sort of like, his heart rate might reach 80 at some point if you asked him a really tough question. But of course, Stephanopoulos didn't ask Joe Biden tough questions, because that's the other thing that we used to see, which is that was sort of normal about it, but not in a great way, which is that Democratic candidates, when they're interviewed by major media figures, tend to get softball questions and not the kind of aggressive follow-up that, like I said, I thought Savannah Guthrie did a quite good job with when interviewing, rather than town halling, President Trump.
The toughest questions came from the audience, actually, in the Biden thing. Like, they busted his chops pretty good. Go, Nick.
Yeah, when you think about the Twitter fiasco and then you think about the Biden town hall, it was a joke, and it would drive anybody insane who was not in the tank for Joe Biden, because you have the former, a Democratic wonder boy back in the Clinton years, George Stephanopoulos, not even lobbing softballs. He was putting tee balls up for Joe Biden, who could barely hit them. And the only thing that people the only thing that people remember out of both of those things is the fact that Joe Biden said, cops should shoot people in the legs rather than trying to kill them. So it's like, even in that kind of safe space, a totally padded room for Super Joe Biden, he still managed to say something totally weird and screwed up. You know, that's what came out of that. I actually thought that Trump was very good in his town hall because he, as Peter was saying, like he interrupted or he pushed back, but he was not a dick. And he actually seemed to have a pretty good command of, you know, okay, this is the job. I've been in it for 4 years and I at least know where the bathroom and the coffee machine is. And it's weird. I'm not a Trump fan at all. I have two dueling scenarios in my head of like, what would be better for libertarians ultimately down the road, like a Trump win or a Biden win. And I could run either scenario, but I think if the Trump who showed up at that town hall had showed up, you know, even half the time over the last 4 years, he would be winning even with COVID, because he was authoritative, he was pugnacious, but he was also kind of with it in a way, you know, that he just, it can be such a colossal jerk off most of the time that like he alienates even people who generally would rather see him in the White House than Biden.
Slade, what, if any, takeaways did you have from the town halls?
So I am an example of the rare, true, undecided voter in that I have been vacillating between casting my first ever vote for a Democrat and supporting Joe Biden this year or abstaining in the presidential race. And the thing that has really been the hang up for me, you know, is not that I disagree with Biden on virtually every policy, which I do, but it's his unwillingness to answer this question about court packing and the fact that he's been dodging and dancing. And at one point, about 8 days ago, said in an interview, he was asked, don't you think that the voters have the right to know where you stand on this issue? And he said, no. And that to me is just unforgivable. And it made me question the things that I thought I knew about him, which is that, yeah, he's wrong about everything, but he's somebody who at least wants to bring the country together rather than, you know, divide people and in this sort of us versus them way that Trump isn't capable of doing anything else.
Slade, do you think that gives some credence or validity to the Trump campaign's repeated argument that Biden is just a puppet for the radical left?
No, I don't think Biden is. But this issue is important to me. And it's one where I had seen it as an example previously of his sort of what we all believe about Biden, which is that he is ultimately sort of, you know, blows in the wind moderate who's going to go where he thinks the voters are. And so the fact that he was refusing to come, you know, not even just to come out against court packing, but even to like give any sort of like, well, let me explain to you my thinking about this. He was just straight up refusing to answer the question. I found that unforgivable. In the town hall, he was asked again, and to Stephanopoulos's credit, I'm also a critic of George Stephanopoulos, but to his credit, he followed up and sort of asked again when Biden tried to avoid the question. He said, don't you think voters have a right to know? People are trying to decide whether or not to cast a vote for you for president. Don't they have a right to know? And finally, Biden said, yes, they do have a right to know. So he reversed his earlier horrifying answer, said, yes, they do have a right to know, and I will give an answer before the election. Now, that's still not good enough, in my opinion, because as was just mentioned on this podcast, the election has begun. People are voting. I'm looking at my absentee ballot sitting next to me right now, trying to decide whether or not to vote for Biden, and if so, when to actually mail it in to make sure that it gets counted. So saying I'll give an answer before election day is a really, really weak sauce answer, but it was at least an answer which was better than we had gotten from him before. And so I was glad to see Stephanopoulos press him on that.
Can I ask just, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, Stephanie, but I am going to put you on the spot. So you disagree with Joe Biden on all policies. You're repulsed by his refusal to answer a basic question. And you're still considering voting for him.
Yeah, because I think because of what I said a moment ago, which is that I think right now, the thing the country needs more than anything else is somebody who will at least make an attempt to unite people, who won't talk in terms of, you know, red states and blue states, and I'm only responsible for COVID outcomes in the red states, you know, who will not do the things that Trump has done to tear the country apart. And that I think has played a real role in leading us to where we are, where there's like literal civil strife in our streets in many cities right now, including the one where I live, which I don't love.
But Trump hasn't done that.
I think Trump has played.
Well, I don't want to litigate Trump's presidency, but it's like this is where I think one of for me coming out of the town halls, one of the main messages is like people are expecting, and you know, and I expect Biden to win, and I expect them to win pretty handily. But people are going to be like, okay, we're going to be able to go back to normal. Like whatever normal was, you know, under the Obama years, the country was pulling apart in a lot of different ways. And people like Joe Biden stoked that division. But if my theory, which is not unique to me, is that Donald Trump is more the effect than the cause of problems, it's not going to go away. And I don't see Biden, a return to normalcy is going to be a federal budget that starts at $6 trillion and then adds on Biden's extra money regulation on top of that. It is going to be a series of Democrats who will almost certainly take the Senate as well as keep the House, push through 2 years of truly atrocious legislation that is designed to even scores, you know, real and imagined that they've suffered under the past 4 years. I don't see Biden as a unity candidate.
Let us indeed not relitigate the Trump presidency in the last 5 minutes of an hour-long podcast. But make a mental note to actually do something like that in the run-up to the election, because I think it's a pretty good and valuable both conversation and brain exercise. I just want to make a note for if anyone, God help you, decides to rewatch any of either of those town halls from last week, watch Biden absolutely flail when I want to say in respect to Camille Foster, when a young man with black skin, as opposed to a young black man, asked him a question like, why should black people vote for you? It is pretty kind of cutting and short question to Biden. And Biden reached desperately like a drowning man for every passing piece of driftwood of a memory of a thing that he might have once said that had anything to do with potentially race-related things throughout his 47-year career. It was amazing. It was completely, completely free association, incoherence, talking about the amount of reading that you might do to a kid when they're oh my God, this redlining, that. Unbelievable, completely incoherent, kind of wonderful in its own way. But also,
Matt, would you also stump for your Joe Jorgensen town hall?
Yeah, go watch it. I linked to it at Reason. Go check it out. I asked her a bunch of questions, and you know, she's been in the arena before. She's a 1996 Libertarian Party vice presidential candidate with Harry Brown back in the day, and yeah, she's out there. That's an hour long. It goes snippy, and you could see.
Were you more Savannah or George? Could you characterize your performance as moderator, which is what will be standing when the aliens come in 1,000 years and survey the wreckage of this once great planet Earth, Gaia?
I think mostly in terms of room raider, and I think my room is definitely a six. Perhaps a five, and the hair raider, my God.
Yeah, now the headband is taking you down a couple notches. You took the headband off, though.
I did.
You put on a suit and tie, actually, at least a jacket and a tie.
I tried to clean up a little bit, you know, but it's going to be a losing battle. Oh, that reminds me, plug to our great friend Kennedy. Her show is back on the air beginning tonight on Fox Business Network in the 8 o'clock hour, and I will be on, as will Joe Jorgens and other people. But look in the 8 o'clock hour throughout the week and throughout the weeks as our friend Kennedy is back on air with lots of Reason guests, including later on this week. So that's good. Thank you, Nick, for prompting.
Nature is healing.
Nature is healing, Peter. Let's go to our end of podcast. What the hell have you been consuming in your cultural orifices? Suderman, what did you do? Peter?
Those heroin suppositories. Finally, I get a chance
what
to talk about
them.
What did
I do? Yes. That's always a worrying question. I watched the trial of the Chicago 7, the new movie written and directed by Aaron Sorkin of The West Wing on Netflix. And God help me, I liked it. I couldn't help but like it. It's not maybe a great movie, but it's well made. It's engaging. I just love the idea. I love Sorkin's idea that dialogue, that words should be interesting and entertaining. And his whole sort of theory of writing and of drama is that you're not trying to create excitement and engagement through sort of ordinary plotting. You're trying to stage a battle of ideas as interestingly and excitingly and thrillingly as possible. And he does that so well. It's also not a very accurate movie in a lot of ways. He takes a lot of liberties with the actual story, and in particular with the characters who are involved. And he uses it as a vehicle to stage contemporary debates about democratic moderation versus, you know, kind of Bernie bro leftism that just don't in any way map onto the actual people who were involved in the trial. On the other hand, this is also his follow-up to Molly's Game. Molly's Game was the first movie that he directed himself. He's been a writer and a producer for a long time, but didn't get into the directing game until late in his career. And like Molly's Game, The Trial of the Chicago 7 is, at heart, a movie about how the state screws people over because it doesn't like them for political reasons. And in Molly's Game, it was that the state decided to screw over somebody who had run a gambling operation for celebrities. And the state just decided, we're going to go after this person and we're going to do everything we can to deprive her of her rights. And there's a great Idris Elba lawyer character who is pretty much just sort of there to deliver a couple of snappy quips. And then at the end, like some monologues that might as well have been Pope hat tweet storms about how the feds will just screw you over at every chance. They will always lie to you. And in the trial of the Chicago 7, the resolution to this story is that this was a political trial staged for political reasons, that it wasn't an attempt to carry out justice, but instead an attempt to advance a political cause. And to do so because people had exercised their right to protest an unjust war. And, you know, so even as much as I find this movie sort of irritating, and I get why people don't love Aaron Sorkin, I think there's something to appreciate there, both in terms of his craft, his ability to tell a story engagingly, and in terms of his interests and his themes and the ideas he keeps coming back to.
Nick, can we stage an intervention with Peter? Just like,
why? I like dialogue-driven dramas.
People,
sorry.
Thank you, Nick.
But I was thinking as you were talking, Peter, that you know the trial of the Chicago 7 is similar to this kind of a leap, but to the Twitter or to the Streisand effect thing, where you know it was a classic case of where the then establishment was putting people on trial, and they ended up just giving them a gigantic megaphone. To spread their sick, yippie, infected, you know, radical ideas. The only thing for me, I'm looking forward to watching it, is that I always kind of get sickened a little bit the way that once radical ideas get recuperated into mainstream politics, you know, a little bit down the road. And I think something similar, and not in a good way, happened to the Goldwater campaign in 64, which was much more screwy and much more disturbing than I think libertarians tend to give it credit for now. It was much more kind of crypto-racist and about morals and the morality of the country and things like that than it was about, you know, just being free to live however you want. But
what have you been consuming, young Nick?
I watched, and this also, I think, comports with Peter a little bit in that, you know, one of the benefits of the lockdown and the collapse of the theater, you know, both movie theater as well as dramatic theaters world, is that we're seeing a shift to new ways of distributing, you know, high quality content. I watched Heidi Schreck's a version of Heidi Schreck's What the Constitution Means to Me that was filmed for Amazon and released on Amazon Prime. It was a play that was in New York for a while and got a lot of kudos. It was shortlisted for Pulitzer Prize and whatnot. Heidi Schreck, it's basically a one-woman show talking about women's rights, the women's rights movement, the ERA, and the Constitution, and the way that the Constitution either has or has not fulfilled its promise of protecting women in particular over the course of its history. It is, you know, her interpretation of the Constitution is absolutely wrong as far as I'm concerned. Ideologically, I'm opposed to what she is very much talking about, a kind of living Constitution. You know, I disagree with that, but it's incredible drama. And it is, again, you know, what I liked about it is it's very polemical. But it was totally engaging. It's all dialogue, and it's a fantastic watch on Amazon.com. It will make the originalists, will make the textualists. It'll make, you know, most anybody who is, you know, left of Ruth Bader Ginsburg probably make their head explode a little bit. But it's fantastic theater. And it's both interesting because it's idea driven. It's all dialogue. There is no action in the thing, but it's riveting. And then on top of that, what I find also really fascinating is just that we're able to see this in the same way, you know, that Hamilton got shown on Disney Plus over 4th of July. It's great. I think it's great to see the ways in which, you know, dormant, if not dead industries are starting to try and figure out ways to get their stuff out to people.
Slade, what have you been consuming?
As mentioned, I've been very interested in sort of what the hell is happening on the political right. And so I recently received my copy of We Should Have Seen It Coming, From Reagan to Trump, A Front Row Seat to a Political Revolution, which is a book that sort of tries to answer this question. How did we get from Reagan to Trump? What is going on among sort of conservatives and the Republican Party? And specifically, you know, the surprising sort of twist being the party previously of, at least allegedly of, limited government and individual rights is now the party of authoritarianism and theocracy. And how did that happen? So this is a book by Gerald Sieb. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right. He's a longtime Wall Street Journal sort of chronicler. And since I've been following this and interested in this question, I'm curious. I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I'm curious to see kind of what his answer is going to be to this question of, like, how the hell did we get to this point?
Does he have a working theory, or what's his thesis early on?
It's not real clear. It's more of a narrative, I think. You know, he's been around a lot longer than I have, so I'm just curious about his first person. You know, he's watched it happen, whereas I've mostly read about it.
Speaking, Nick, of different ways to consume things, we over the summer, in addition to buying a COVID car, we bought a COVID screen projector. It doesn't really make sense, but so we can watch movies on our patio and you know, bug the neighbors with our movies. And so we've had a few screenings. And on,
man, if you get speakers big enough inside your house, you can bug the neighbors with your movies without going on your patio.
I prefer the communal experience.
Matt, please watch Frozen outdoors during the first snowstorm in New York.
That's a great idea. Thank you.
We were actually have a Dr. Zhivago party for the adults.
We were talking about, like, we have to move to kind of snow related things while we shiver and watch with our friends. But we screened, and it was kind of an interesting exercise to do this on Friday, Borat. The first one, not the sequel, which is making its way to, you know, YouTube trailers around, with the idea of, like, I remember watching this movie whenever it came out 10, 15 years ago in L.A. And laughing so hard that, like, I think I strained a rib cage muscle and just crying and weeping. So what's it like to see it, more than a decade later? Without the element of surprise, so you know that the wrestling is going to happen and some other stuff, and will the joke still hold up? Will it be cringe? It's still pretty funny, still pretty funny. And more than ever, the real winner in it is America. It's the country that Sacha Baron Cohen was trying to satirize as being backwards. All these, like, really nice kind of people trying to cope with an awful Kazakh in their midst.
What do you think of him now? I mean, because he's so
he's
hostile.
Very rancid. My presumption is that the new Borat will be really terrible and mean-spirited. But then there's something about that, and Nick, your dark heart should appreciate some of it. That's kind of what makes the original Borat sort of funny, because he is that bad. And, like, it takes a special dark-hearted person to go not just and, like, have an awkward dinner table scene about using the bathroom, but then coming back with a bag full of poop in his hand, like, which is just a cruelty to these kind, you know, Southern people and having a dinner party. But there's something to that. So, like, leaning into Sacha Baron Cohen's hateful darkness is actually what makes the whole thing funny.
Just to tie all of this back together, Sacha Baron Cohen is in the trial of the Chicago Seven. He plays Abby Hoffman.
That just, there's no way that movie is good. There's just zero chance that that movie is worth anything except a burning party of some sort.
You can't burn it. It's on Netflix.
Put that on your tombstone. Okay.
Have you watched Cuties Outdoors yet, Matt, by the way? I'm assuming that's why you got the projector.
We live it. We don't have to watch it. Okay. That's all the inappropriate content we have time for. Make sure to listen to all of our terrific podcasts. The recent interview with Nick Gillespie, the Soho Forum with Soho Forum people on Fridays. And you can see them all at reason.com/podcasts. And we'll catch you next week, including pretty soon. We'll have a special episode during our webathon, which is coming up, in which we're going to solicit your listener questions. And in general, maybe kind of start making that more of a thing on this. So if you have questions that you specifically want to hear Nick yell at you about, or Suderman find
monologue about,
monologue like a Marvel Comic Universe thing, or to me construct metaphors, or Catherine to make it all about space travel, private space travel, and whatever other traumas are going on in her life, send them our way. We'll figure out a mechanism for that later. But anyways, just start the process of getting yourself ready. And that's it. Goodbye. See you next week.